Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Chris Farrell, in the day for Carrie Miller. Do you remember what the economy was like a decade ago during the global financial crisis and the Great Recession? A housing bubble burst. Home prices fell by an average of 30% around the country, and the collapse in values took down the economy. The unemployment rate nearly doubled. The stock market plunged by about half. Lehman Brothers failed. Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns were absorbed by big banks, and so on. In 2010, the Dodd-Frank law was passed to prevent another major financial meltdown. Last week, Congress voted to roll back several Dodd-Frank rules that included thousands of small and medium-sized banks. The momentum has shifted toward easing regulations. So, are these changes good for the economy? You know, the kind of adjustments you make with the benefit of hindsight and experience. You know, 2010 was quite a few years ago. Or cumulatively, is the American taxpayer more likely to be on the hook to bail out the financial services industry sometime in an uncertain future? My first guest is Keith Ellison, U.S. Representative for Minnesota's 5th Congressional District, and he joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Representative Ellison.
Hey, it's great to be on. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Okay, so you were opposed to the rollback. What is your reasoning?
Well, the bill on the four corners of it is not good. The fact is that the bill lowered the threshold, actually raised the threshold from the level of scrutiny banks would get from about $50 billion to $250 billion. Now, what that meant is that under the Dodd-Frank bill passed 8 years ago, that systemically important banks that if they fail, that they would hurt the whole economy, were put under special level of scrutiny, and that was banks that had $50 billion or more. We've raised that to $250 billion, and I see that as a real serious problem. And here's why: if you look at financial institutions like Countrywide, which is infamous for the damage that it caused our economy, it's valued at $199 billion. So now, if Countrywide would not be regulated under this new system, SunTrust, same thing, $208 billion. They're below the $250 billion threshold. Ally Financial, 164, Barclays US, 175. These big financial institutions that are clearly systemically important will escape regulation, which will make our economy much more likely to have to have serious problems as it had before. I remember when Barack Obama became president, the first month before he even got sworn in, this economy lost about 741,000 jobs in a month. I mean, it was terrible in those days, and, you know, we passed regulations to prevent these things from happening, and here we are 8 years later rolling back. But that's not the end of it, Chris. I mean, you also have a very important regulation called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. This piece of legislation is designed to make sure that all Americans can expect to be treated equally and fairly when it comes to mortgage lending.
Right. So this was the attempt to make all that 250, 400 pages worth of paperwork. I don't know what it is, but it always is a big stack. Make it a little easier for the potential homeowner to read.
Well, right. But the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act requires lenders to give information to the government on the race and ethnicity of people who they lend to or don't lend to. And what this means is it stops a very bad practice called redlining. You know, in our country, there's a long and very, very sad history of African-American families who have the money, have the down payment, have the credit, have all that, but get turned down or get turned steered to high interest loans. Well, Home Mortgage Disclosure Act requires that the government get, you know, that these the government receive data so that we can track these kind of things, because it's very easy to deny that you're discriminating. But when you look at the pattern of information, it's very clear that the discriminatory patterns exist. If you don't have the data, then you cannot say to a bank, you know, you can say whatever you want, Mr. Right. Banker, but you clearly have made race the factor in this mortgage decision.
Well, Congressman, you know, I want to ask you.
And they're getting rid of those requirements.
Right. So I want to ask you, though, as a follow-up. Now, the supporters are saying, look, this rollback is good for Main Street. It's going to free up a lot of credit.
Yeah, that's what they say. But I absolutely think that this is absolutely wrong. And let me tell you why. Because, remember, you know, this bill takes place within a certain context. We just passed a major tax bill that allows many of these huge banks to cut their taxes dramatically. They're going to use that money and the money they won't have to spend complying with regulation to do what? Amass more income to do what? Buy more banks. The number of community banks has been going down steadily over the course of the last several decades. It's not because of regulation. It's because of monopolization. It's because of markets getting concentrated, banks getting bigger and bigger and bigger and having more money to gobble up smaller banks. That's the problem. And because what we've done is just made a giant step towards giving more to the people who have the most, and they're going to use it to enhance their market position, which is what we would expect them to do. So it's not going to help small banks. Now, look, let me tell you, I actually support small banks. If they would have said we're going to increase the limit for systemically important financial institutions from $50 billion to $100 billion, you might have had me. If you didn't do anything to the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, you know, there was a way for me to support a bill like this, but this one goes way too far, and it ends up not being a bill for small lenders. It's a bank for big ones. And by the way, it's not like banks don't have a lot of money, Chris. They're awash in it. I mean, they are awash in money. They have plenty of it. Bank of America reported record-breaking quarterly earnings on Monday. Filings show that the company reported about $1.4 billion in tax expenses in the first quarter of 2018, more than $500 million less than it reported in 2017. I mean, these guys are making all kinds of money. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, there's a group out there called Americans for Tax Fairness. They found that Fortune 500 companies are getting 10 times as much in tax cuts as they are giving the workers in bonuses and wage hikes. So the big companies with these tax breaks that they just got in December, these things have a compounding effect with this bank bill, because many of the companies that benefit from the tax bill are benefiting from this regulatory relief bill.
So one last question. Is this it, or do you expect that there'll be more bank legislation before Congress?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're not going to stop trying to relieve the banks of their responsibility. They're going to continue to do that. And the reason why is that, you know, it's so much of the revolving door. They get people who leave Congress, and where do many of them go? They go work for lobbyists. Which lobbyists are sometimes bank lobbyists. And what do? They come back to Washington and they say, we need more. And it doesn't matter if their profits are exploding, and it doesn't matter, you know, how much money they're making. They always need one more thing to give them a few more bucks. Now, if I may just add one more thing, Chris, because I know you got to go. Americans are facing all-time consumer debt because they are with the, you know, in 2008, people were over-leveraged. They leveraged down. They got out a lot of a debt. Now we're right back up where we used to be. People are awash in this debt. It's not good for the economy. If interest rates go up, people are going to be in a world of hurt. And I just want to say, you know, that Timothy Pawlenty, you know, was the top lobbyist for the bank bill. He worked very hard to get this thing passed. And, you know, that's just part of, you know, what happened in this whole scenario. He was a major player.
Right. And you know, he's running here, as you know, for governor. But I'd like to thank you very much for your time. Yes, I think you were aware of that.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for your time, Congressman.
All right, see you later.
All right. Keith Ellison is U.S. Representative from Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. now like to turn to two experts that dive deep into financial services regulation and deregulation. But first, we really want to hear from you. Call us at 651-227-6000 or toll free at 800-242-2828. Online, it's talk@nprnews.org. What is your question about bank deregulation? So with me in the studio is Neil Kashkari. He's head of the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis, and he also oversaw the Troubled Asset Relief Program, better known as TARP, for the U.S. Treasury during the financial crisis. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. Great to be here.
Jenna Martin is a professor of law at West Virginia University, and she's co-author of When the Levees Break, Examining the Failings of Our Securities Market. And she joins us by phone. And I'm glad you could join us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Neil, this is actually a good time to be having this conversation, not only because of the recent legislation, but global investors are increasingly nervous with Italy and its collapsing bond market and this sort of little, echoes of 2012 with Greece and Portugal. So how are you looking at the current, just to set the scene, how are you looking at sort of the current global financial markets?
I think overall the global economy remains strong. The U.S. economy continues to remain strong and create a lot of jobs. We had seen in the last few months, or the last 6 months or so, strong overall global growth. It now seems like the U.S. economy may be leading the charge in terms of leading growth, but we're obviously paying attention to Europe. I mean, these things tend to flare up, then hopefully they flare back down and things calm down again. You know, we need to pay attention.
So I want to read back to you from a Wall Street Journal op-ed piece you wrote last year, and you calculated that, and I quote, "The odds of a bailout in the next century are still nearly 70%. Now, that was before the latest deregulation vote. And I have to say, to me, 70%, I don't like those odds.
I don't like those odds either. And, you know, the work we've done at the Minneapolis Fed, we can reduce them. You can't make it zero. You know,
right.
It's like a terrorist event. You can never say it'll never, ever happen again. And there are trade-offs. To make us safer, we have to spend more money. Freedom or safety is not free. So we can actually reduce the odds of another financial crisis down to around 10% or less if we substantially increase the capital requirements on the biggest banks in America.
And just define for it, what do you mean when you say capital requirements?
So this is just like when you buy a house. My wife and I bought a house in the Twin Cities, and the bank made us put 20% down. The more money we put down, the safer the bank is in case I run into trouble, because they can then sell the house and get their money back.
And I think the default rate, if you go back to the financial crisis, if you put 5% down, was fairly high. But if you put 50% down.
50% down, there's almost no default, right? So the more you put down, the less the default risk. Well, the big banks in America today put only about 10% down on their investments. They make us put 20% down. If we made the biggest banks put down 20% on their investments, we could actually protect the taxpayers.
Okay, and the big banks love you. I know they do. but I did want to one other additional question was the cumulative effect. You know, it's very easy to get caught up in this piece of legislation or what's happening here, but this sort of cumulative effect. So you had this legislation, Trump administration's looking to ease some regulations that are still in place for the biggest banks like JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup. Banks are hiking their dividends, they're really, embracing stock buybacks. When you look at the cumulative effect, are we moving back to a too-big-to-fail system?
Well, we are. We're moving in the wrong direction. And the biggest risk, if you look at all of human history, there have been financial crises because we forget. We forget how bad it was. We forget what caused it. And then we repeat the same mistakes because we think, oh, it can't happen again. Well, it can happen again, and it will happen again, and we're now moving in the wrong direction.
So, Jenna, I was reading some of your work, and You wrote this line that you said you're worried that after the next crash, institutions will not be too big to fail. They're going to be too big to save. So what does that mean?
Well, I have to say I agree completely with Neil in terms of the concentration of banks in the market right now. I think the bigger and bigger that banks get, we're going to be in a position where corporations and the banking industry is actually bigger than the government. And so when it comes time that the bill comes due, in essence, we won't be able to bail them out like we did in 2008.
So you just written a book. What would, give us the brief encapsulation of what you think we need to do? Because, you know, one way of looking at Dodd-Frank is that it was very conservative legislation. It sort of strengthened the existing system. It wasn't anything particularly radical or different. It just made the existing system work better.
Or one could say it made the existing system work worse. I mean, there was a lot to Dodd-Frank, obviously, and this bill that just got passed does some actual good for consumers. My concern, though, and what we were talking about in the book, is that the way that we have addressed regulation for the last few decades has been this sort of reactionary piecemeal approach, right? So we have a crisis, we have a scandal, and then Congress steps in and legislates. Whereas we would rather take a proactive approach and, you know, we say sort of snarkily in the book, burn everything to the ground, start from scratch, and really re-envision how, in particular, the securities markets, but the financial markets more generally, should be regulated.
So is this – why do we have 50 state insurance departments? Why do you have 50 state bank regulators? Why do we have, you know, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency? Why do we have the federal – I mean, we have so many regulators that are playing in this market.
We have a ton of regulators playing in the market, and we talk about that in the book. But there's a lot to it, right? So one of the biggest things that I focus on, I used to work at the Securities and Exchange Commission, so I focus particularly on the securities markets. And the way that we regulate that through the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Act of 1934 is so out of step with how investors trade right now that it seems like we're sort of trying to regulate a computer with a dodo bird. It just doesn't work.
So we have some calls I want to get to. But now before we do that, there was this wonderful essay years ago by Andy Haldane, and it was called The Dog and the Frisbee. And it was what he said is that, you know, a frisbee, if you actually look at the calculations to catch a frisbee, it's really complicated, right? But a dog can do it. And a dog has some simple rules of thumb. So when you're, Neil, when you're proposing capital ratios, is it essentially, look, here's a simple rule of thumb, and in return, we'll regulate the banks less? Is that the basic trade-off?
It is, because we can never predict 5 years from now or 50 years from now what new security Wall Street's going to invent.
Which is what Jenna was talking about, where
We're always behind. So the one thing that protects us against future innovations is just making sure banks have their own skin in the game and enough of it so that if they screw up and when they screw up, their investors bear the losses, not the taxpayers.
Yes, but they always say, I learned my lesson.
They always do. But then
those
folks,
it.
They retire, and then their successors forget the lesson.
This is true. Well, let's go to John. And John, I believe you're in Minneapolis. Hello, John? John?
Yeah, I'm here.
Ah, so what is your question?
My question is, I'm kind of curious how this legislation even made it through Congress to begin with. I don't imagine that deregulating the banks was something that was on every American's mind, such an important thing to get done, you know, with things like no water in Flint, Michigan going on, and other financial worries across the country. How did this even make it to there? Are there strong lobbyists in the industry? It just doesn't seem like it's a big topic for every American out there.
Jenna?
Well, the nickname actually for the bill, according to some of the authors, was the Bank Lobbyist Act. So I think you're right, John. I think that part of the reason why this bill has been or made it through is because the lobbyists made it a top priority and touched the right people and talked to the right people so that they made it a priority in the legislative session.
So let me give out the number again, and then we'll go to Marty in Rochester. But give us a call if you have a question about financial services industry, bank deregulation. Give us a call, 651-227-6000, toll free, 800-242-2828. And Marty, what would you like to ask our guests?
Sure. My question, I'm a former financial advisor, and I'm actually on my way to a groundbreaking for someone who did a localized security offering for their business. And I'm wondering what local bank and small bank deregulation can do to help that so that someone it was not a credit investor can take their money in their savings account or their IRA and put it into a securitized local offering. Right now, that's really difficult through a Regulation D or Regulation A offering. But can local banks work with that better through deregulated marketplaces?
So is this investing through community banks?
Right now, you have to invest directly with the owners. But wondering if local banks, if they were a little bit looser regulations would be able to facilitate that much better, so that you can keep more of your money local rather than putting it into the Dow Jones and et cetera.
Okay, so I'm not the expert. I'm going to turn to Neil, but my sense is the devil is always in the details on this kind of initiative.
Yeah, I have to say I'm not sure either how much this new banking bill would actually allow that. I think there are lots of rules on making sure that investors are accredited, have certain net worth, et cetera. I'm not sure that this would change those standards. I don't know if the professor has a better view of this.
Jenna?
So one of the provisions in the legislation did provide for sort of looser regulatory aspects of Regulation A+, which does lead to sort of increased capital investment. But I think you're right, Chris, the devil is in the details. It all depends on whether or not this is a state security issue, whether or not banks have been licensed as state security regulators, and the law itself does not address that.
So I want to ask you with the raising the capital, and it's a pretty, I don't want to say simplistic argument, but it's a pretty simple argument. I mean, you can paint this picture fairly well. What is the trade-off? And if you go to economists, whether they're conservative or more liberal bent, they're fairly strong. I mean, the debate comes down to, well, it should be 15%
right.
rather than 20, or maybe
right.
it should be 30%, right? But that's a different kind of debate. And yet, this sort of discussion is not gaining traction in Washington.
I know. Right now, the regulatory winds are blowing against us. We put out our plan in a very public way, all open to public scrutiny and criticism, and nobody's been able to poke any holes in it. And, you know, we may debate, like you just said, some of the fine tune. I may make this assumption, you might make that assumption, but more capital is the most powerful tool we have to actually protect Main Street and to protect taxpayers. Now, banks hate it. Because it means their profits are going to go down.
Okay, so walk me through that, because one of the banks do hate it. And their argument is, look, your credit's going to dry up. I mean, what are you going to do? What? Don't you like Main Street?
Right. And this is where their arguments are completely disingenuous, because while they simultaneously say that capital requirements will hold back lending, they're buying back their stock billions of dollars a year. Now, the only way those two statements can be true is if they are turning away good borrowers and instead choosing to buy back their stock. The truth is they're buying back their stock because they're not finding good places to invest it. And so if we force banks to issue more capital, Main Street will not lose in lending and the U.S. economy will be safer. Everybody wins except for the shareholders of those banks.
Jenna, you want to add something?
And can I just add as a corollary, this idea that, you know, banks are needed to sort of free up the capital markets. The reverse wasn't true, right? So when TARP was enacted, part of the reason why TARP was enacted is because the idea was we would give money to these banks and then banks in turn would loosen up the credit and make foreclosures sort of not happen in light of the money coming in from the government. And it didn't happen, right? The idea of TARP, in part, was to prevent the financial crisis from getting worse, but it was also to be able to increase lending down to consumers, and that didn't happen. So it seems disingenuous to be able to say, oh, if we have this regulation, this is going to prevent us from giving money to consumers. When we did it, it didn't actually turn into something that gave money to consumers.
You agree with that?
I mean, I think so. I think that that's right. I mean, it speaks to the fact that banks lend. It really matters on how the broader economy is doing. And if the economy is doing well and there are creditworthy borrowers, banks are in the business of making loans. So if a creditworthy borrower with a good idea comes to a bank, that's the bank's business model to make that loan. So the idea that capital requirements are holding back that lending, it's just laughable. But, you know, I give banks credit. They're willing to make nonsensical arguments to advance the interest of their shareholders. And that, I mean, you know, I guess I can't blame them.
That's called capitalism.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go to St. Cloud. Tyler is in St. Cloud. Hello, Tyler.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if the Treasury borrows money from the Federal Reserve and that's how money's created, where does the money come to pay for the interest?
So, okay. Hold this.
Sure. Well, so the Federal Reserve controls monetary policy to set the goals that Congress has given us, which is stable prices and maximum employment. So we move interest rates up and down. The Treasury is not borrowing money from the Federal Reserve. The Treasury is borrowing money from investors around the world. They issue short-term bonds and long-term bonds up to 30 years, and people hand their money over in exchange for that interest rate. So it's the difference between fiscal policy, which is the business of the Treasury Department and Congress taxing people and deciding what to spend on, and monetary policy, where the Federal Reserve is setting interest rates to try to manage the ups and downs of the economy.
And so let's go to Ray from Orono. Ray?
So my question is, do we have a more fundamental issue with bankruptcy and the rules of incorporation? When you look at it, any entrepreneur knows that the upside potential of investment is unlimited and the downside is limited by bankruptcy. Corporations regularly separate their divisions so that if they bankrupt in one, the rest of the corporation is untouched. And when people use other people's monies to invest, this means that it's free reign to gamble.
Well, okay. So I know I have my response to that, which is that that's what entrepreneurship is. And you limit the downside so that people will take a chance on a new idea, a new organization, a new way of doing business.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's right. And that's how the free market and the capitalist system is supposed to work. What makes banks different for the giant banks is instead of their own investors who put in money taking the losses, it's the taxpayers who are forced to ride to the rescue because the banks can bring down the whole U.S. economy. We want to get to a situation where investors can make their bets, can take their risks, take the losses, and nobody else is harmed. That's where we need to get to.
And Jen, I imagine when you were working at the SEC, this is the kind of question that would come up.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting, this idea of other people's money, right? Because on the one hand, you're right, we want to be able to encourage entrepreneurship. We want to be able to encourage people to take sort of risky ideas and potentially make them huge. But at some point, it seems like the incentives have sort of been skewed so that now people are really focusing on we can just spin off this division. We can just turn this into something else. If it gets too big, the taxpayers are the ones that end up bailing us out. And that's a problem.
So let's go to Chandra in Minneapolis. Chandra?
Hi. My question is for Mr. Kashkari. If MS is deregulation effort, right? If saving the large banks is what we wanted to do, what impacts does increasing the reserve requirement out of those banks do? Would that help?
Yeah.
Explain what the reserve requirements are.
Well, reserve requirements, it's related. It's where the banks have to invest their money. So they have certain assets they're allowed to buy. They could buy treasury bonds from the U.S. government. They could invest their money in mortgages. They have reserve requirements, which means they have to store some of their cash at the Federal Reserve. It's another form of increasing the capital requirements on the banks, making sure that they're not doing very, very risky things. It's a way of deleveraging the bank. So in general, if you increase the capital requirements or the reserve requirements on banks, you reduce the riskiness of the things they're allowed to go do, and that should make them safer. So overall, that is a net positive in improving the safety of banks.
Gentlemen, we got a call from Sarah, and she said that she worked at Lehman Brothers. And mm-hmm. She has this nice question, which is, how do you stop banks from finding loopholes in new rules? I mean, you had to be dealing with this.
No, absolutely. And it's an excellent question. It's one I've been thinking a lot about. I think part of the issue is that we have to tighten up the regulation, right? So part of what happened with Dodd-Frank is in the post-Dodd-Frank world, Congress punted on a lot of things and pushed it off to the SEC to create all these rules that would then sort of be subject to more influence by the banking industry. I think if we made the laws at the beginning simpler, right, and cut down on the amount of regulatory sort of muck that all these agencies had to weigh into, that would be a huge start in getting it down. Because the SEC still hasn't finished all of the rulemaking that Congress asked it to do from 2010. And it doesn't have the funds to be able to do it, doesn't have the resources to be able to do it. So I don't blame the SEC for not being able to do it. But I think trying to cut down on the regulation will go far in preventing some of these loopholes from happening.
So Neil, explain something to me, because I do this, talk about the banks. But when you look at the financial services industry, I mean, there are giant insurance companies, global insurance companies. I mean, AIG got itself in trouble during the financial crisis. Some of the private equity funds now, I mean, we're talking enormous portfolios. you have some money management firms, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars. So when we're talking about too big to fail, is it a bank problem or is it a financial services industry problem?
Well, it's mostly a bank problem, but it could increasingly become a financial services industry problem. So that's why what we did in our own Minneapolis Fed's Too Big to Fail plan, we actually level the playing field between banks and what we call shadow banks. You know, because if we just clamp down on the biggest banks and all of the risky behavior runs to a hedge fund, is the system any safer? So what we've done is we've leveled the playing field so that there's no more incentive for this activity to move from a regulated entity to an unregulated entity. So you're right. We need to pay attention to that. But the reason that banks are so risky is because you and I deposit our money in banks and we can withdraw it tomorrow. But then they turn around and make long-term loans with it. And so all of a sudden, they can get stuck if all of their customers say, I want my money back, but they've used that money to issue long-term loans. That's why banking is riskier than some of these other activities. We call it in the lingo, maturity transformation. They take short-term loans from us, and they turn around and make long-term loans. And that's what makes banking fundamentally a risky activity.
So I'm curious, in this whole area, You talked about the capital requirements, but you also have some interesting experiments. I think there are experiments going on in Australia and Canada where with their housing market, rather than using the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy, which affects everybody, to try and cool off the housing market, yet you target specific regulations at the sector. Is that something for the Fed to be considering?
It's something we should be paying attention to because you're right. Let's say we thought home prices were soaring again. How could we cool it off? If we raise interest rates, we're going to cool down the whole economy, not just the housing sector. So what some other countries have tried to do, for example, is increase the down payment requirements on those homes to cool off that hot housing market. They've shown only limited signs of success so far. And, you know, I think in Vancouver, if I'm not mistaken, they imposed a big tax, something like a 15% tax on foreign purchasers. You know, you might end up needing a very blunt tool to cool down a hot housing market. We should be open-minded about learning what's happening around the world.
So speaking of blunt tools, Jenna, the Securities and Exchange Commission was not a big player during the whole financial crisis and in the aftermath. And, you know, when I started covering the financial markets in the 1980s, I mean, the SEC was everything. I mean, that's what people talked about. That's right. What people were concerned about. And frankly, you know, the benefit of, you know, at the time during 2008, 2009, 2010, we were talking about Treasury. We were talking about the Fed. But right. We weren't talking about the SEC.
I think that's the result of a number of factors. First, I think the number of agencies that have gotten involved and the interdependence between the sort of underlying products that the agencies are being involved has just skyrocketed since the 1980s. I think the reason why people were talking about the SEC in the 1980s is because the SEC was the agency at issue when it came to securities, and that's no longer the case. The other thing that I think has changed is that the SEC, at its core, still regulates primarily by disclosure, and it still regulates primarily corporations. Obviously, it's getting into a lot of the other securities, and part of what's happening with this new regulation, this new law, is that it's directing the SEC to sort of study algo trading, which is huge now and dominating the securities markets. But the SEC is still focused on this idea of corporate disclosure and requiring corporations to sort of disclose everything in their quarterly reports. And that's just not how people trade. Right. When people are going in and trying to buy a stock, they don't say, oh, well, I've looked at Apple's quarterly report for 2008, and that's why I've decided to do this long term investment. No, they care about Apple as a stock. They care about what Apple is doing as a stock. And so we need to now make the SEC more relevant. And the SEC right now, based on the way that they're regulating, they're making themselves irrelevant.
So, Neil, one of the things that I like about the capital requirements is that we have a regulatory system that has largely depended on disclosure. But do we really know what's going on in the banks?
No, absolutely not.
And one of the things you can come away from the financial crisis is that even the bank executives, which we assume knew was going on, they didn't really know what was going on in their banks. So does the capital requirement in the time remaining, does that deal with ignorance?
It's the best defense we have against ignorance. And look, businesses make mistakes. Big businesses make mistakes. No offense to Boeing or Airbus, when they announce a new jetliner, you can be pretty sure it's going to be years late and billions of dollars over budget, right?
Yeah.
Big businesses make mistakes. But when they make that mistakes, you know, every other business in America is funded at least 50% equity virtually. Only banks have convinced us that they need to be only funded 10% equity. So if big banks were like any other business in America, like Boeing, when they make a mistake, they have enough skin in the game to withstand it, and they don't have to turn to taxpayers.
And not to be cynical, but when you have that kind of leverage in a bank, does that improve the pay of senior management?
Of course it does. Stockholder returns, return on equity, share price, and stock options for the management and the boards of directors. Absolutely. That's why we are where we are.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed this, and I don't think we solved the problem, but I do think that we shed some light,
some illumination. Thank you.
Neil Kashkari is head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and Jenna Martin, who joins us by phone, is a professor of law at West Virginia University.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.